Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
While the staff and crew at Research on Religion takes a break to finish up some other academic commitments, we offer you a recent panel discussion on proselytism from the good folks at the Religious Freedom Project of Georgetown University. Listen to Alan Hertzke, Ani Sarkissian, Brian Grimm, and Hans Ucko share their perspectives on how religious proselytism shapes modern societies. We will return soon with some more fresh and tasty nuggets in the coming weeks, so please stay tuned and check out our Facebook fan page and our Twitter feed to see what's coming up in the future. All right, here's the folks at Religious Freedom Project.
Well, my name is Alan Hertzke. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma and one of the associate scholars here in Georgetown. And we have just a really distinguished panel to focus on the issue of proselytism, social stability, and political development. So we're going to look at some of the political dynamics. And let me introduce, and I know it's late and you've been through, so we're going to make this very conversational. And we're going to make sure we have more time for questions. And we'll be crisp with our answers so that we can get to more questions. But we have a really distinguished panel, and so I'm going to introduce them now briefly. And you can read more about them and their work. To my immediate left is Brian Grimm. And if there's ever a person who is truly a pioneer in the field of global religious freedom, it is Brian Grimm. Brian is the one who developed the mechanism, the methodology to actually measure restrictions on religion, which was then used, has been used and is being used at the Pew Research Center for their massive global restrictions on religion reports. He also co-wrote the book, The Price of Freedom Denied, in which he and Roger Finke apply that methodology to an understanding of the linkages between religious freedom and other social goods. And he's now the president and the founder and the president of a Business and Religious Freedom Foundation, which I'm sure he'll be able to talk about. So he brings an extraordinary amount of experience. He travels the world, and we're just delighted to have Brian with us. Next, we have Ani Sarkissian, who is an associate professor of political science at Michigan State. And as I was reading through her vita, I was just stunned by how prolific she is and how in such a short scholarly career. And she is the author of a book that just came out, which is central to this topic here, Varieties of Religious Repression, Why Governments Restrict Religion. And she's also written a paper, The Freedom to Proselytize and the Quality of Democracy, which we will get into here in a few minutes. And she's also, of course, an associate scholar of the Religious Freedom Project. And finally, Hans Ucko is an ordained minister of the Church of Sweden, and he has worked at the very highest levels of interfaith dialogue with respect to proselytism and developing codes of conduct. He was with the World Council of Churches. He worked with the Vatican. He worked with the World Council of Churches, the Vatican, and the World Evangelical Fellowship at the highest levels to develop codes of conduct. And he'll be talking a little bit about how that came about and what he's learned from that experience. And so our plan here is to have a conversation. I'm going to throw some questions out. I'll let our panelists respond, and we're going to let each of them kind of provide something unique to the conversation, and then we're going to open it up to you all. So I want to start with kind of the whole discussion about proselytism. There's been a lot of discussion about what it is. Is it abusive? Is it uniquely abusive or inherently coercive? Or is it just a term that's become pejorative without necessarily any reason? And so I thought I'd just throw out to the panelists just your reflections on the word proselytism, and if you can distinguish it from witness or conversion, and what you'd add to what we've heard already in the discussion. So Brian, you might start, and then we'll let the rest of you chime in here.
Thank you, Alan. It's good to be here, good to be at Georgetown, which, by the way, is a Catholic university. And so I thought, I have four cans of worms that I'm going to open up if there's time. And
we'll let you open this later.
Yeah, this is the first one. My first can of worms is that the Pope said, don't proselytize. And since I'm Catholic, I think that that's just the end and we're done. Then I can just sit down. But it might be good to read a little bit what he said. So the Pope said during his weekly Sunday Angelus there at St. Peter's Square, addressing the skeptical in the crowd, he said that the Lord is calling you to be part of his people, and he does it with great respect and love. The Lord does not proselytize. He gives love, and this love seeks you and waits for you, you who at this moment who do not believe and are far away. And this is the love of God, Pope Francis prayed, that all the church may be steeped in the joy of evangelizing, invoking the aid of the Virgin Mary so that we can all be disciple missionaries, small stars that reflect his light. So the Pope said, he doesn't believe that we should proselytize, but, you know, this is a pretty nice description of what we've been talking about, sharing faith, witnessing.
Missionizing
even, but sharing love. And you know, the love that he talks about often, if you hear him, he speaks very eloquently about the gospel that's read every day by Catholics. And you know, he talks about the Good Samaritan. And if you think of the Good Samaritan story, one of his favorites and mine, the Good Samaritan was a foreigner with a foreign religion. And he's our model for somebody who should do good. And this radical idea of what Jesus is and what Jesus had to talk about is something the Pope is very animated about. And all the world should get in touch with this exciting new thing that's so radical that love is more radical than radicalism. And, this is what animates the Pope. And he hopes all the Catholics get out and talk about that. But that's not proselytizing. That's, you know, just sharing our faith in what he calls evangelizing. Quite an interesting perspective, and people have all kinds of takes, but I thought that might be a good perspective that I could share.
Thank you, Brian. Yes, Ani, anything to add to this?
So we've talked a lot today about restrictions or about proselytism having a negative connotation, and a lot of my research has to do with putting restrictions on religion, and so one of the things that governments try to do is restrict the type of coercive or fraudulent proselytism that of the type that many of us disagree with. But I think that to kind of steer the conversation in a little bit of a different direction, but one that I think is more relevant to power relations and how politics become involved in the question of proselytism is, you know, we talked about this a little bit, but who gets to decide what is coercive, fraudulent, negative proselytism? Do we want states doing that? And do we want to put a government in the position of deciding whether a message is coercive or fraudulent? Another way that I like to think about proselytism is, and in terms of restrictions on proselytism, is related, things that are related to proselytism. So proselytism is not just standing on the street corner or delivering aid and trying to teach people about your religion while you're giving them this aid. It also includes things like public preaching, so, you know, going out in the open and talking about your religion. It includes publishing religious tracts. It includes having, radio programs where you talk about your religion. And so when we think about how proselytism might be restricted by states, we also need to pay attention to some of these other ways that religions are being restricted and prevented from spreading their message. And I think one of the things that I like to bring this back to is basic freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And so proselytism is not just about sharing your religious message, but it's about sharing your views on all sorts of things. And so when we do get into issues of whether states should be involved in restricting proselytism or not, we need to keep in mind some of these other types of issues that are often tend to go along with restrictions on proselytism.
You know, I like your point about introducing a different kind of power dynamics, because I thought Ruth Messenger's point was very compelling, that, you know, how is it received by a very vulnerable, needy person? And you're saying, but the state is a powerful actor. And when the state engages in deciding to restrict religious proselytism, what does that mean? So we'll be exploring that further. And Hans, I think this might be a great opportunity, actually, for me to ask you to describe how you came to this work as a minister, and really looking at developing a code of conduct, because it's a fascinating story, and it does come from what you were hearing or what people were saying on the receiving end, in other words.
Yeah. Well, I will actually begin by saying it began long, long before I became a minister. Because, if I may say so, I'm a convert. And from Judaism. But not, I should say, not a practicing Jew at all. But nevertheless. And the moment it had become known that I was a convert, I came across so many Christians who had, I felt, very strong and strange comments on either looking upon me as a hero, announcing the coming or return of Christ, now are the end days, you are the one who is carrying the church. And this to me, on the receiving end, said something which I kind of had some problems with. And one of the problems that I've had today, in a very, very interesting, so I think having a problem doesn't mean that I'm against it, is that the first issue that comes to mind when it comes to religious freedom seems to be whether or not I can proselytize. To me, this is not number one on my list. I would also like to quote the Pope, but only a sentence, namely Pope Benedict the 16th, who said, quite poignantly, I think, "The church does not grow by proselytizing, but she grows by attracting others." And this is what I think the church and every religion should be all about, not to go out and kind of make the other an object for my desire to have him or her become what I am. So I would like to say that first as my kind of creed, that I think that it is strange that the first thing that comes to mind in the context of religious freedom is the right to proselytize. For me, religious freedom is what someone said in the session before, to be allowed to believe what I believe, to be allowed to express it, to be allowed to be genuine to my faith, to be allowed, if asked and invited to, if anyone is attracted by it, to answer according to my faith. But not kind of, for me, proselytize is bad, because it suggests that I'm out to get others. Now, you asked how...
Can I interrupt for a minute?
Yes.
And see if we can carry this... That's great, Hans, but I want to carry this conversation a little bit, something that's implied there, which is proselytism, does it carry a negative connotation because it implies a transitive act? In this sense, I'm acting on the other. I'm trying to, as you said eloquently, making the other an object of my desire. Or does it have to be that? Or is there some agency on the part of the person that you're persuading? And do we sometimes undermine that notion that the person being persuaded or converting has agency as well? I'll let any of you maybe...
I mean, I don't know. First of all, you have the language, English. So you may say, no, proselytize is completely neutral. But if I go to the Ecumenical Dictionary, which has worked with concepts such as mission, evangelism, proselytism, it is there said it's negative. There it is said the term has acquired the negative connotation of the perversion of witness through secret or open improper persuasion, such as bribery, intimidation, or external coercion. But I think it's important. I'm a theologian. I don't know about what states are doing and or so. I'm a theologian. And in theology, there is a very important German word, which is Wirkungsgeschichte. What is the effect that this maybe once upon a time completely innocent concept, proselytism, has had throughout history? And today, if you go out in the street, I'm sure, if you ask anyone, they will say it's negative. And so I think we need to take this into consideration. So for me, it's negative, but I'm a foreigner to this country and to this language.
You're pretty eloquent foreigner, I must say, Hans. Yes,
I can say that when states regulate religion, they understand, when states regulate proselytism, they understand it negatively. So it's framed usually in a negative context. So
in
it's
terms of inducements, coercion,
fraud. And many times, my expertise is more in democratizing and authoritarian states. It's worded in a way that targets specific groups that are perceived as using these negative means. And so I think that's part of the reason, I think, probably, that we have this negative connotation with proselytism, when I don't think that we necessarily have to. If we think of it as a neutral idea of sharing your religion and trying to convince others to share that as well.
Good.
So
yeah, Brent.
Everybody has a data sheet on your paper, and the definition I have there of proselytism is just to share your faith with someone else in the hopes that they join you in your belief, or it's worded a little bit differently. And that's how I measure it. So if I wear my social science hat, I don't measure proselytism as the attempt to coercively or underhandedly trick somebody into changing their faith. So as I measure it from a social science point of view, I just take it as the attempt to share your belief with someone else in hopes that they join you in that belief. And sort of one of my other cans of worms, the very interesting thing, I think even this whole day is talking about something that's becoming less of a problem, because according to the statistics that are on this paper, 7 years ago, 25 countries had instances of hostilities over proselytizing. In the most recent year, 2013, only 12. There's been 12 countries have had cases where there have been hostilities over proselytizing. There's been a remarkable drop in this. So, not to spoil, I mean, we maybe could have gotten off after my first point about Pope Francis said don't do it. It's also becoming less of a problem according to the data.
So before we turn to how big a problem it is, I want to get back to you, Hans, and have you share with us a little bit of how you came to then the work with the World Council of Churches on developing a kind of code of conduct, as it were. And perhaps you've been successful because there's less tension over this issue.
Maybe.
So, as the social scientist here says.
So I was the staff person in the World Council of Churches for some 25 years. And the World Council of Churches is then Orthodox Protestant Fellowship of Churches. And so particularly from India, Sri Lanka, we had recurrent requests that we address the questions of proselytism because, and this came from our member churches, because it particularly maybe after the implosion of the Soviet Union, in many countries around the world, and also then in India and Sri Lanka, there were quite a few groups from outside, or paid with money from outside, from the US, Finland, South Korea, who came to India or Sri Lanka, and they proselytized, or they witnessed, or they, in a way, that targeted, it was said, the, as was said also before, the Adivasis, the indigenous people, or the Dalits, and so on, in a way that hadn't been that frequent. And it resulted in, as was also said before, that some states considered to make conversion unlawful in India. And problem for the churches, the mainstream churches like Lutherans or Anglicans or Orthodox, was that their age-old institutions like schools and hospitals and clinics that they had been having for hundreds of years suddenly were seen by the authorities, or the Christians feared that the authorities would look upon these institutions as attempting to convert people. So that's why they said, you have to do something about it, because our activities that we've been doing is being jeopardized.
In other words, you're saying the churches themselves were saying our work in ministries is being undermined because people are associating us with aggressive, perhaps evangelizing or something.
And
like
then,
that.
Factor number two, those with whom we were in dialogue, Hindu organizations, Buddhist organizations, they said, isn't that what we've always known? Basically, you are out there to proselytize and convert us. And when then we or the mainline or the indigenous, the churches in India, Sri Lanka, and said, no, it's not we. They said, we can't tell the difference, whether it's you or someone else. We've seen now your real face. So that's why we, and when I say we, it's not only the World Council of Churches, but also the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue in the Vatican, we decided to embark upon a project which we hoped would lead to a code of conduct on conversion. Because we didn't think that to legislate against conversion or to legislate against proselytism is not good, because you end up in a question, what is now conversion? In what way are you really, is this proper or improper and so on? So what we wanted to was instead to make the churches take a stand morally, ethically, and say, we are against any activity that uses or abuses young people, differently abled, vulnerable categories in society. We definitely say we are against this, and this should not be part of what we call the witness of the church, the mission of the church, or the evangelization of the church. So then we began this for a number of years. And we first then wanted to hear from people of other faiths. So we invited to an interreligious hearing, what are Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Jews saying about Christian presence, activities, witness, proselytism, and so on. And here we got some very salient points, and I've mentioned them in the blog that comes out of this RFP. Now I've forgotten the name. Cornerstone.
Cornerstone. So we'll refer people to your to your blog.
And then we got on the way the World Evangelical Alliance saying we would be interested to be part of this. So we were three constituents: the World Council of Churches, the Roman Catholic Church, and the World Evangelical Alliance. And then in 2011, a document was kind of agreed upon. I wished it had still been called a code of conduct on conversion, but I think I can say it now that Pope Benedict wasn't very glad about the code of conduct, because it was said he recalled the Da Vinci Code, and that kind of turned him off completely. So now it's called something else, agreeing on issues of conversion or something like that.
Very good. Well, let's move on, and let me address the issue that sort of has been kind of a subtext of the whole day, which is the notion that somehow there is a kind of predatory proselytism, and we heard this actually from a letter from the Hindu American Foundation, and others are concerned about what are seen as abuses of human rights or predatory proselytism, and so or cultural genocide, to use that word. So how big a problem is this, you know, abuse of proselytism? And I'd like all of you to kind of, maybe Brian, you could elaborate a little bit, but how big a problem is, in a sense, the abuse of inducements, fraud, power differentials, or coercion, in your view? And I'll let the
others. So, I mean, the biggest abuse happens through the prevention of people being able to choose freely their faith. And that happens in countries that prohibit conversion.
So in other words, the problem is actually the countries that prohibit conversion prohibit people from freely exercising their agency.
Yeah, so within a context where you are born in a faith and you're expected to die in that faith and the government supports that, that's government coercive. You could say it's not quite proselytism, but it's the prevention of proselytism. So I would say that's where the big problems come. And then when you have that as the situation, then that same government will probably also prevent proselytism because they don't want any challenges to that status quo. So the government itself, by setting up laws on preventing people from having a free choice to have freely choose their faith, change their faith, or have no faith at all, when governments prevent that, then that creates the situation in which proselytism becomes really a hot topic. It creates more social. So the data chart that you have in front of you is reminiscent of what my 4-year-old grandson says when he looks at numbers, and he always has a good joke. He says, "Why is 6 afraid of 7? 7, 8, 9. That really, you'd be surprised how many people around the world have never heard that joke. But so it really gets a big.
7, 8, 9.
Didn't you know that?
I didn't know that joke.
Really?
I'm going to tell that to my grandson.
Yeah. Grandkids love it. But that data chart might be a little bit of why 6 afraid of 7. But when you look at it, you see that when governments restrict proselytizing, and those tend to be the same ones that restrict conversion, that social hostilities across all 13 measures that are measured in the study are higher than in countries where they don't. So that tends to be what the bigger problem is. It's not, that then sets up a case where someone who's proselytizing, then someone drags them in front of the police and say they've been proselytizing, and then if the police don't do anything, vigilante violence can then be focused on those people. And this happens in a number of countries. India is one where it's quite common. So I think that that's the important counterbalance to this question, is that there certainly are cases where coercion is used in matter of religion at the state level, but then at the local level where people are proselytizing, perhaps that's also sometimes, that can be a problem. But I would say it pales in comparison to the power of the state preventing people to freely follow their conscience. Mm-hmm.
I agree with Brian, and I think if you look at the motivations for restricting proselytism, one of the major ones is following some sort of either religious law or upholding religious law. So you find this in a lot of Islamic countries that where states will try to uphold laws against conversion or anti-apostasy laws, but not only in Islamic states. The other example that you have is in states that have a very kind of strong nationalistic bent. And so you find this in a lot of Orthodox Christian countries as well, where you have restrictions on proselytism. And that argument is a cultural preservation or group preservation argument. And so you have, on the one hand, this tension between religious and secular law. On the other hand, you have a tension between group and individual identity, and group and individual protecting groups or individuals. And those are valid arguments, I think, to have, and valid tensions. But when you have the state taking one side and enforcing religious law or enforcing kind of cultural preservation, who's targeted? Who is harmed? It's oftentimes religious minorities or minorities in general. And so I think that that's a very big problem with proselytism, is when you get the state on the side of enforcing restrictions against proselytism. I don't know what the data. I don't know if there are data on instances of unethical proselytism in a country. That would be very difficult
to measure
and to collect. But we can look and see what states are doing, and states have enormous power, and they do tend to use it against minorities.
Hans, what is your sense on how big a problem sort of abuses of missionary work?
Of course, I don't have any statistics, but I can only go to sermons, homiletics on mission. So I can hear there the justification for going out and bringing the gospel to the heathen or the pagans. I mean, this is so old. And it didn't, as someone also said before, I mean, the missionaries didn't come alone. It's so intertwined with colonization, military, and so on. So I don't know if today you can say so and so many were kind of forced to convert. But Ruth, I think, she talked about the Jewish experience of forced conversion, all the conversos. Maybe not all, but quite a few of them, and in many other contexts and so on. And then there is also, it needn't be that you put someone, you take a gun and you say, convert. It can be that you yourself feel, this would maybe be the best way for me. I mean, we talked, I think, earlier about China. And in my days before I joined the World Council of Churches, I was the Asia Secretary for the Church of Sweden Mission. And in China then, we saw, and other countries, English schools teaching English was the most popular you could imagine. Why? Because it helped people to master English and thus come a bit closer to the West that they admired. So in that is all, there is also a subtle, I don't know if it's intentional, but a subtle way to kind of provide language schools that the church is paid for in order to teach English, but behind it could have been also another reason, a hidden agenda. Yeah, I'm fascinated.
The joke is that every English teacher in China is a missionary,
yes,
basically,
yeah.
And many are, yes.
Last week, I met with a friend of mine who is from Nepal, and he has been out serving the UN, UNICEF, and so on for I don't know how many years. And now he came back, and he told me that Nepal used to be a Hindu kingdom. People were thrilled, absolutely thrilled, when this was abolished and you had a secular democracy. Today, people are almost longing for the days of the Nepalese kingdom. Why? Because of all those groups who have come into Nepal to missionize or convert or whatever you want to. So I agree. What we need to be very vigilant on is the question of when states, for instance, in Muslim countries, in Saudi Arabia, the greatest ally of the U.S., there it's not even allowed for Christians to come together for prayer and worship, where the state is interfering. But there is among some churches, some Christian religious organizations, an intention to bring the pagans or heathens or whatever to Christ. And that is maybe sometimes done in a way that I find against a code of conduct on conversion.
Well, let's switch the conversation now. What's interesting to me is we, in a sense, agree that there needs to be great sensitivity when you view the other as an object, and when there are power differentials, as has been raised earlier. And but there's also kind of a view that when the states are involved, we have a different dimension. And that's what I'd like to turn to now. So I want to start with you, Ani, because you've done work on the way in which restrictions on proselytism or conversion or mission work relates to the quality of democracy. And this is fascinating to me, that you find that there's really a strong correlation here between restrictions and the quality of democracy. So why don't you share a little bit about that, and then we'll have Brian talk about social hostilities.
So I'll have to emphasize the word correlation, and I've tried to get at the causality a bit, and I'm throwing out a lot of social scientific terms here, but so I have tried to kind of look at countries that, you know, if you control for their level of wealth and levels of ethnic and religious heterogeneity, their dominant religious tradition, the ones that have restrictions on either proselytizing or related activities like restricting conversion, restricting religious literature, public preaching, they tend to have not only lower levels of democracy in terms of procedural aspects such as elections or number of parties that are allowed to compete, but they also tend to have lower or they seem to have less protection of things like freedom of assembly, demonstrations, open public discussions, freedom for non-governmental organizations, labor unions, freedom of the media, cultural expression, freedom of travel, employment, even into the business, the right to own property, establish private businesses, personal social freedoms, whether they're allowed to choose their marriage partners, the size of their family, and also equality of economic opportunity. So there are, I'm really interested in looking at what the outcomes are of restricting proselytizing.
So you're saying that when states, under the banner of, say, protecting indigenous populations or existing traditions or the dominant majority, when they restrict proselytism or conversion, all of these other things are linked with that.
They are.
And in a sense, that's the dangerous thing about state engagement in this arena.
And of course, I mean, there is I have to kind of give the statement that there is a chicken or the egg problem here as well, right? We don't know if it's because they're democratic that they choose not to restrict proselytism. And so they've already had all of these great things, and then they decided that, okay, well, we're also not going to restrict proselytism, or if it's the other way around. But so far, what I've been able to do with the data, doing the appropriate types of controls, seem to suggest that there is a causal arrow in that direction.
All right. Brian, why don't you describe a little bit about, I mean, your vast work in this area.
Well,
I haven't seen your chart, but
I'll share it with you.
Okay,
they're
you.
On the table.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Speaking of chickens and eggs, all right, so from a social science point of view, if 13 things all work in the same direction, it's hard to say that's an accident, all right? So in this chart that you have, I'm afraid of...
Oh, that's all right. I'll look at it later.
Yeah, on this chart you have, there's 13 different kinds of social hostilities, and all of them are higher when the government restricts proselytizing. So there's a relationship there. And in fact, if you look sort of down, two-thirds of the way down, five times higher levels of hostility over proselytizing in countries where governments restrict proselytizing. 39% of countries that restrict proselytizing have incidents of hostility over proselytizing, whereas only 8% of countries without a government restricting it have hostilities. So these things, I mean, you can argue chicken and egg, but when things just work whenever you can put a chart together like this and it's not just random, there's a real relationship there. So I think it's very clear that when governments get involved and start micromanaging what happens in faith, it often has a unintended consequence of stoking tensions. And maybe sometimes even those tensions are intended to be stoked.
Yeah, and many times they're justifying those restrictions, saying, well, we're imposing these restrictions to minimize the hostility, but it's not, it's actually making things worse.
Well, the other side of this, if you flip my data chart the other way, it means that peace is 5 times more likely in countries where proselytism's allowed over this issue of proselytizing. So I think that's the other side of it.
That seems so paradoxical.
So why is it that proselytizing might be associated with more peace? Well, I'll give one.
Yeah, I want to know what the mechanism is.
Well,
here.
The mechanism is very interesting, and I'm going to open my next can of worms.
All right.
Indeed, it is. Yes.
Good demonstration. Visual aid.
I received no money from Coca-Cola Company, but to give an example of Coke taking on a religious problem, and it parallels how proselytism works, is everyone is probably familiar with the divide between Pakistan and India that happened after the British pulled out. And so it's predominantly a Muslim North Pakistan and a Hindu and multicultural South called India. And Coca-Cola wanted to market this on both sides of the border. And what they realized, the marketing teams who were Muslims in Pakistan, these aren't people in Atlanta, but Muslims in Pakistan, the local team, and Hindus in New Delhi, they said, if we market this as an Indian drink, a drink for Indians, we're going to lose the Pakistani market, and vice versa. If we market this as a Pakistani drink, we're going to lose the Indian market, because then they're not going to want to drink the drink of the presumed enemy. So Coke did an amazing thing. They took the risk and they made what they call a small world project. And you can see this on my foundation's website or you can find it on YouTube, where they got Coke machines and put one in a shopping mall in New Delhi and one in Lahore, Pakistan, India and Pakistan. And then they had people come up and get a Coke. But when they came up to the machine, instead of just seeing a machine, it was a live video link to the people in Pakistan and vice versa. And then you found out that you could touch hands. And then through these video screens, new technology, and you could then dance together. And the video is really fabulous to watch. And by the end of it, if you have a heart, you'll have tears in your eyes. Even if you have a cold heart, it'll melt it to see this. And Coke is selling a drink that's not really all that, you know, nutritious. And there's a lot of problem with that, and I am not advocating for Coke. But the business was really proselytizing, saying, this is the thing for everyone. This is the answer. Coke will bring people together. And so that desire to get your message across made them try to bring people together so that it wouldn't be just a thing for one side or the other. So I think that that's part of the mechanism in proselytizing, is that when somebody's proselytizing, they're going out and they're trying to help somebody who's not from their faith understand their message. And when you do that, you know, you're hitting somebody who might be very hostile to your faith. And then in that process, I'm not speaking of coercive proselytizing, but what we've been talking about, sharing your faith, what Pope Francis calls evangelizing, in that process, then they're going to say, well, you know, I don't think science backs up the idea that God even exists. And then pretty soon you're into a dialogue of going where you are to where they are. And that then is what really interfaith dialogue's about, right on the ground. And that's where, you know, sort of gab fests often fall short. And where maybe missionary work has a much greater impact, or people out on the ground, is because they're actually encountering other people on the ground, not just intellectuals and other people, but talking with them and having their views challenged. There's been plenty of missionaries who have, you know, wow, I don't know how to answer that question, and challenges their faith. So proselytism goes both ways.
And Ani, yeah, go ahead.
I really like that anecdote, and I like what Brian is saying, and I agree that that dialogue is something that a very positive thing that can come out of proselytism. But that assumes that the person that you're proselytizing to can defend what it is that they believe in. And one of the objections that you found, I did some work in the post-communist countries. One of the arguments that you find with the, you know, Orthodox churches there who
were
objecting to, to, you know, American evangelicals coming in, were saying, you know, you're sheep stealing is what they refer to as proselytism. You know, these are our people. For decades, we weren't allowed to teach them about our religion. Now you're coming in, you're teaching them about your religion. You're not giving us a chance to get them back to their native religion. And so you can understand why it would be objectionable to them, why they might be offended by people coming in when they feel like, well, they have no chance then to argue with these people who come in with money, who come in with resources, with training, who know how
to... Is the money one of the dimensions of power differential, Hans? And I mean, the idea that the Westerners have lots of money that they're bringing to the evangelism, is that
yeah,
something
they
that...
they come with Coke, and Coke is attractive if you haven't had it for 70 years, like in Russia. I mean, I know that today's Russian Orthodox Church plays a very difficult role in nationalism and so on. But I can very well understand, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after 70 years of pushing the church, Orthodox Church against the wall, of taking away churches, of not allowing education, of putting up alternatives to confirmation or to and other rites, so to say, in the church, that then after the implosion of the Soviet Union, in comes American evangelical churches, lots of money, many cokes, and soup kitchens, and provide that which people have been longing for and have been deprived of. I can understand, exactly as you say, the resentment that grows out of that. And Russian Orthodox Christians, the leadership said to us, if only these evangelical churches in Finland or South Korea or the U.S. had come to us when once the Soviet Union broke down and said, we could come and work together. Could we use the church for the distribution of the soup that we have brought or whatever? But no, that was kind of their own apparatus, imported and neglecting the voice of the churches, the local. I can understand the resentment. That is why we cannot just talk about proselytism, mission, and so on without the Wirkungsgeschichte, the history of the effect it has had throughout history.
Well, can I add, I think the counterexample to the Russian experience is Brazil. So Brazil's, when I talk to most Catholic cardinals that I've talked to about this, including the two in Sao Paulo and Rio, you know, it's a touchy subject because Brazil has gone from being 100% Catholic to two-thirds Catholic. A third of the population has left the Catholic Church, and they have religious freedom. Well, how's that good, you know, from a Catholic point of view? Well, Cardinal John O'Nikin, Catherine, you know him, several of you know him, he said, well, whenever I talk to Cardinal Arani and Scherer, I say, well, you guys really didn't have those folks in the first place. Because, no. You know, the norm in Brazil was they just assumed everybody was Catholic, and you need to go to Mass at least once a year was the rule. You know, and for people that are religiously interested, once a year just doesn't do much. So the evangelicals came in, and the Baptists came in, and the Mormons came in, and the Jehovah's Witness came in, and the Seventh-day Adventists came in, and a third of the population now has shifted, and the Catholic Church, you know, Cardinal John from Nigeria commenting on this, he said, well, the church just didn't have those. They weren't meeting their needs. And so now the Catholic Church itself is realizing we've got to do something. We've got to meet people's needs. So that's how I would respond to back
but
to
Brazil
the Orthodox.
And Russia or Soviet Union, completely different.
But I would the same is that people were not very well Catholicized. The parallel in the Soviet Union, people didn't have an Orthodox faith. You know, the average person.
They were not allowed to.
They weren't allowed to, but they still didn't. The church is very weak. So the best challenge, I would argue, for the Russian Orthodox Church and the way to get it to get strong and be muscular is to have a little bit of competition and have to get out there and work for their souls, so to speak.
I mean, I'm not the spokesperson for the Russian Orthodox Church. But after 70 years of being imprisoned, and it isn't and not used to the world of competition, Pepsi Cola, Coca-Cola, it is quite a lot to ask to say, oh, get your act together, up there and compete. It takes time, and particularly if, as in the Russian Orthodox Church, what it was kind of remembering old days. And today, this is the temptation for the church, to think that the old days is the thing, and forget that, there are, of course, Russian Orthodox priests who today understand the meaning of aggiornamento, that the church has to be here today. But the 70 years of imprisonment has not really been doing very much but keeping the church as a remnant of the past.
You know, it's interesting, and we're going to turn to some questions in a minute here, but there's a fascinating paradox here that's sort of emerging, which is that there's a lot of hostility or ambivalence or concern about proselytizing and the power differentials and so forth. But as we've heard from both Brian and Ani, there's a huge problem when the state then attempts to repress that, and it results in undermining democracy and creating religious hostilities and so forth. And which suggests to me that the kind of the self-regulation and the enlightened understanding of what sharing your faith is probably the best antidote. It's mutual respect. It's respect for the dignity of the other, but not bringing the state into the calculation. I just wondered if you all have some thoughts about that. Yeah.
Just very quickly, this is kind of related, but also a response to the competition argument, which I'm very sympathetic to as well. What competition did in the case of the Russian Orthodox Church was push it to lobby the state to get more restrictions put on other religions.
Into Putin's lap,
in
some sense.
So competition can be good, but it can also push desperate religious groups to then go in a different direction, rather than innovating and trying to keep up with these groups, say, okay, well, then we're going to try to get the state...
Cut a deal with the coercive power, the sword of the state, in other words. Yeah. Well, let's open up to some questions. Yes, we've got one here. I guess we've got the microphone people with alacrity moving through. So, question here.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak with us. I found Hans's comments just really sober and refreshing and absolutely consistent with the intellectual tradition that I think we celebrate both in the context of the West and definitely here at Georgetown.
Put the microphone a little closer. But, closer here. Yeah,
at Georgetown. But I really found actually quite problematic the comments that came from both Annie and Brian. And specifically the last comments, but then we could perhaps move backwards to the conversation. But this notion of bringing like market language into the concept of human souls, where you're literally dealing with individuals and entire populations as mere commodities to be captured, is incredibly offensive to human dignity, I would argue. And then I guess like when you take it slightly more reflexive and actually with taking into account the knowledge, the societies that you're speaking of. Brian, your comment about Brazil, as someone who is South American, whose family's in Brazil, I could tell you that it's actually largely about community, not about ever having owned the souls or having held on to them, but rather maintaining community. If one person in your family is risked being disconnected because of their relationship with an American church, you're making a choice of either we join them or we lose them. And that's really the dichotomy that many of the evangelicals take into the communities, whether it be in Russia, in India, Latin America, in Africa, et cetera. And so I think that the conversation is necessarily more nuanced than has been presented. And I think that there is a level of respect that must come across in your discourse. And
I think that's a very trenchant question, so we'll let Ani and Brian respond.
Well, yeah, I think your point's exactly, you know, I take your point very well. I would say that there's two very important things, and they are summed up by how Jesus responded to the young lawyer. You know, how do I get eternal life? And Jesus said, what does the law say? Well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Who's my neighbor? Well, the Samaritan who's a foreigner with a foreign religion. And perhaps the other important story is the prodigal son. So it's accepting anyone back. So it's really, you know, when I personally think about, you know, my own faith and what it has to offer, that's, you know, those are radical ideas. To accept somebody back who's thrown everything in your face, the prodigal son. And to have my neighbor be really the person who is absolutely nothing like me. So that's what I see as what, when I talk about the Orthodox Church, if they're not living that out, and if they're not able to be authentic about what it is to be Christian, then if someone else can and spark that light, like the quote I read from Pope Francis, these very small dots of light that can really illuminate the world. That, you know, that's what I'm talking about. I use market language because I'm a sociologist of religion working from the religious economy's perspective, and so I've adopted some of that, which can, if you're in a meeting of sociologists of religion, that, you know, we can talk that way and nobody's offended. So I understand what you're saying. But, you know, from deep within my heart, I think that when you have freedom for real faith to come out, then it's so powerful, and that's what's lacking. I've met with my Metropolitan Hilarion, and who's the number two guy in the Orthodox Church, and he just bemoans the fact that there's just not authentic faith, even among the, you know, the small priest, you know, the priest legions they have, but in the congregation. So that's the question. So I would see, you know, the ability to have people be free to share their faith as something that can stimulate that. So, no, the Catholic Church doesn't have any souls. I mean, that's the remarkable thing about Brazil, is that the religious freedom came after Vatican II, and all this change in Brazil happened after Vatican II. And it's an example of the majority faith, the Catholic Church, not coercively stepping in and trying to prevent people from following a different path. And there's been relatively no violence and no social hostilities in Brazil. And it's because that majority faith was transformed, I think, in Vatican II to one that accepted religious freedom as the law of the land, not the government needing to protect orthodoxy. So I think that's part of what the story is. And you know, all the things you said, you know, I think they're entirely right. If I were giving a sermon, I would preach a bit differently than if I'm... you know, talking from a religious economies model.
I come from the same perspective as Brian. So as a social scientist, I speak in this kind of markets model, but it's out of a concern with the amount of regulation of religion that I see. And so when you speak about regulation, speaking in terms of markets and economics is just a kind of easier language in which to talk about those things. But I think the choice of religion is a very individual one, but it's also one that has to do with community. And so one of the reasons why proselytism is such a big issue is because it's seen as tearing people away from their communities and breaking up communities. And that's why I'm concerned with the state being involved in kind of trying to regulate that, because then they're deciding which community gets to stay together, and, you know, who gets to do what to which communities. And so that's the I use this language to get a grip on how to deal with these very complicated issues.
In fact, Rebecca Shaw's research on the Dalit women who convert to Pentecostal Christianity shows that they create a community that they feel that they own, and they gain a greater sense of agency then by that act of saying, I am going to be this person. And so in that sense, if the state says, no, you can't become a Christian, you can't show that agency, then they're repressing that community emergence, in a sense. And that's part of what your research is finding. Other questions? Yes, right here. Catherine. And then I'll get you.
Hans, I'd love to hear more about the process of negotiations that went on and what came out of the codes of conduct. What were the main sticking points? And what persuaded people? And I think you were not 100% happy with the outcome. Why not? And what's happening now? What's happened since 2011?
Fabulous question. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the process, I wouldn't say that this is something that neither the process nor the end result is something that has been vetted in the member churches of the World Council of Churches or in the Roman Catholic Church, but been kind of in the councils guiding interreligious dialogue in both the Vatican and the World Council of Churches, and I think in the World Evangelical Alliance. So I should be honest and say it's not like a very wide constituency that has said this is it. I had, the idea was that we realized that we cannot legislate and we shouldn't ask for legislation. And we shouldn't, we should try to do our best to make, for instance, the Indian states not to give up these bills against conversion and so on, because that's not a very good way of a very good modus operandi. What we need to do is to show that church leaders are willing to say, as far as we are concerned, we pledge that in our work we will not proselytize. I use that word now because in the ecumenical dictionary it is a negative word. We will not use the vulnerable, we will not use the uneducated, we will not try to get converts because we are helping out in the post-tsunami and so on. So that was our intention, and to get something of not the legislation but a code of conduct that was clear, where we stated this we will not do. And we didn't arrive at that because, I don't know. I mean, I can't really point to one because I wasn't there anymore, so I wasn't part of that final process. But I think that when it came to pledging and to kind of stating unequivocally those in the constituencies of the Roman Catholic Church of, the dialogue, dicastorate, in the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, World Council of Churches, and the World Evangelical Alliance, they were not prepared to be that specific and that articulate, but let it a bit more vague and harmonizing the language. This is my personal. So I wish there it would have been more.
Okay, we have a question here, and then we'll get these two. I think we'll have enough time.
Thank you. This may be obvious, but is there not an obligation on the person who proselytizes or evangelizes to be informed about what the other person believes, and not to be giving incomplete or wrong information about what is going on? I have a lot of experiences having worked, for instance, in Ukraine and having been to an evangelical service that came in from a bunch of people from Florida. They had electric guitars and violins, and they were wonderful. But they were really dumping on the Orthodox Church. And the final point to me was when they introduced a new hymn with great fervor. And that was a Gloria in Excelsis Deo, which most of us have known, at least since the 4th century.
That's a great question. So,
isn't there an obligation to be truthful?
Anyone want to take that question on?
I think just yes is a good answer.
Yes, here. Yes is a good answer.
I want to thank the panel again. I have a question, and anybody can answer it. We're coming up to the 500th year anniversary of Martin Luther, and Germany for the last 3 years has really been preparing with this worldwide, with the Protestant and ecumenical communities, and also moving this whole notion of universal faith and the universality of the Christian faith, not just the Protestant, but also the Catholic faith. And what you mentioned today about the Pope's recent statements means really there's more and more convergence occurring that way. Is there really, at this point, is there a growing issue in terms of this whole concern with proselytization? Isn't there really a bigger issue that there's also a conflict with over-secularization or radical secularization?
Mm-hmm. Great question.
Which is creating a need for balance, not just by the state, but increasingly by the individual, to have that sort of resonance of a spiritual dimension to their lives?
So that is my question. Brian, go ahead.
I just have a very interesting story about this. I just came from the Vatican, the European Parliament, and the House of Lords in London.
Just
where I came from. I was there on meetings over the past month discussing counter-radicalization. And the consensus is that government programs don't know how to deal with it because they can't address religion. They have to keep religion out of the equation. And the most interesting coalition of groups has formed, and it's based on the idea that there are two problems with violent radicalization, or they tend to be isolated and not integrated, and they tend to be on the socioeconomic margins of society, and then they have a spiritual corruption, add that third piece. Well, I've been working with a consortium of people led by one of the most missionizing, proselytizing, evangelizing groups in the world, the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in their evangelization, now they number about worldwide the same size as the Jewish faith, and they have won converts all over the world. But what they've found is as people have come into church, they're lacking skills in business, education, and how to find jobs. So they've developed this wonderful curriculum called a self-reliance program that helps their church members know how to start a business, know how to get a job, know how to get the education. And that's actually, and that's done in a group setting, and that's actually the most perfect program I've ever seen to counter violent radicalization, is get people at risk into groups like that. And so we've had meetings in these places I've just mentioned where Muslims and Catholics and evangelicals have come and listened to this.
Listen to the Mormons?
Listen to this example from the Mormons. So the thing is that when people are out proselytizing, they're meeting the needs of people. And I'm not Mormon, so I'm just looking at what they've done and trying to, and I've become impressed with it, because in their what they call self-reliance, the first principle is that you've got to be spiritually stand up for yourself and take responsibility or agency. And that's probably what people that are radicalized don't. They give that up to some radical preacher, and they're not taking the responsibility. So, I see what you're saying is that in a secular society, they've stripped us of perhaps our greatest tool. And this is what I float a new definition of religious freedom that everybody rejects, but I think I like it. It's really, at least it's why religious freedom is important. Religious freedom is the freedom for religion to do good. And if religion doesn't use people of faith, don't use that faith to do good for others, I'm not sure what the value, you know, the value of religious freedom is certainly not one that's worth fighting and dying for. So I think that that's part of what religious freedom is about in our secular societies, is people of faith being able to stand up and say, we have something to offer solutions. And we heard about it on several panels today, that faith has solutions where you know, sort of a secular approach doesn't.
So I like your definition. Yeah.
You like that?
Well, there's a great...
Well, I get a lot of pushback on it.
There's a great passage in the Quran, I think it's Surah 52, where it says, had God willed, he would have made many people with many faiths, with one faith. He would have made one people with one faith. But instead, he made many people with many beliefs so they could vie one with another in virtue, so that they could compete with one another to do good. And so the freedom of religion, in a sense, is the freedom to do good, the freedom to show that you can do
adding,
more.
However, ta'aruf, to getting to know the other, that is what you, it's not only to do good, but getting to know the other.
That's the other corollary of that sort, is to know the other and to vie with one another and to know
one another. But if I may, I think that you are right. When there are other dangers emerging, like if I speak from a European perspective, the question of what we do, the cohesion of society, because we cannot just be living in what Germans call parallel societies. Parallel societies. There must be some kind of glue keeping us together. And what is that glue in a post-Christian, pluralist, consumerist, individualist society? And that is a question that I think here the secular society realizes, if I look upon it from my Swedish perspective, the government or the realized that they have failed, but they don't know what to offer instead. So they are asking whether religions could give up their proselytizing, realizing the very age-old ecumenical principle, which said that which we can do together, we should not do separately. So get your act together, religions, and see the whole of the European society, Swedish society, in all its kind of atomization, and come up with something, a spirituality that is sustainable and that is helpful for the cohesion of society.
I'm just stunned by the eloquence of our panelists here. One last question right here. You had a question?
Big issue maybe, but how do you deal with history? You know, India came up many times in the conversation. I spent a lot of time in India. And definitely among the majority Hindu population, there's definitely a very strong sense there was so much conversion by Christians in the past under the British Empire. There were so many conversions of the past of Hindu people under the Muslim empires, etc. And that really causes a very high level of sensitivity, and that's the perspective through which they see everything. So how do we address that in an era where we kind of want to say to all of us, so let's be fair, let's be ethical, let's just be good people, when there's a sense of, yeah, but the gun went off and you got 100 yards down the road before we started to move forward. And related to that, how do we avoid the kind of extreme reactions Hans mentioned in Russia, where the flip side, the Hindu community is a minority, and just last year, through powerful efforts of the state, definitely with the support of the Orthodox Church, there was an effort in court, and they lost, and they even took an appellate level to declare the Bhagavad Gita, the principal Hindu scripture, as extremist literature, and thus have it banned in the entire country. So how do we take into account history and have people see that in a proper perspective, deal with people in a reasonable way, and at the same time avoid the extremes that sometimes swings with these government partnerships or native churches taking the power potential that they have?
Very good question. Anyone want to take that on?
Thirty seconds.
Well, no, I have a story, but it takes too long to tell. It's a question of that one needs to, as has been said before several times, the whole question of what power and powerlessness does to us cannot be underestimated. And I think that this also plays out in India as well as in the Orthodox countries and so on, because your hermeneutics will change according to your power, respectively, powerlessness. And there is a very good Jewish story about that, but unfortunately it's a bit too long, so I can give you the reference.
But you may share that afterwards. No, we do need a break. I want to thank Brian Grimm, Ani Sarkeesian, and Hans Ukko for this wonderful panel, and thank you all for your participation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.